Erin pursed her mouth as though she had bitten a sour persimmon. I'd stop that fool bounty entirely if it wouldn't put the tower in bad odor. A ridiculous waste of coin. Very well. The clerks may send their papers to another for signature. A Brown, perhaps. They like that sort of thing. Moiraine's heart soared before the Ammerlin added, You will remain in Tarvalon, of course. As you know, we will have need of you soon.
As you say, Mother, Moiraine replied, heart sinking into her stomach, down to her ankles after that brief flight.
Offering another deep curtsy, she kissed the Ammerlin's ring once again. With a woman like Ciaran, best to take no chances. Swan was waiting in her rooms when she returned. Her friend leaned forward expectantly and looked a question.
I am free of the bounty, but I am ordered to remain in Tarvalon.
As you know, we will have need of you soon.
She thought that a fine mimicry of Ciaran's voice, if a bit streaked with bitterness.
Fish guts, Swan muttered, leaning back. What will you do now?
I am going for a ride. You know where I will be, in what order.
Swan's breath caught.
The light protect you, she said after a moment.
There was no point in waiting, so Moiraine changed into a riding dress, with Swan's help to make the changing faster. The dress was a suitably dark blue, with a few leafy silver vines climbing the sleeves to encircle the high neck. All of her darkest garments were embroidered, but she had begun to think a little needlework might not be so bad. Leaving her shawl folded in the tall wardrobe, she took out a cloak lined with black fox and tucked her hairbrush and comb into one of the small pockets the cloakmaker had sewn inside and her sewing kit into the other. Gathering her riding gloves, she gave Swan a hug and hurried out. Long goodbyes would have turned to tears, and she could not risk that. Sisters in the corridor glanced at her as she passed, but most seemed intent on their own affairs, though Chiron and Shiriam both said it seemed a cool day for a ride. Only Edith said more, stopping her with a half-raised hand, eyeing her in a way that seemed all too like Lilaine.
"Ruined farms and villages will hardly make for a refreshing outing, I fear," the white-haired sitter murmured.
"Ciaran has ordered me to remain in Tarvalon," Moiraine replied, her face a perfect Aes Sedai mask. "And I think she might see crossing one of the bridges for a few hours as disobedience."
Edith's mouth tightened for an instant, so briefly it might have been Moiraine's imagination. Clearly she had read Ciaran's revelation of the plans in that response, and she was displeased.
The Ammerlin can be fearsome toward anyone who goes against her wishes in the smallest way, Moiraine.
Moiraine almost smiled. Light. The woman had given her a chance to say it straight out. Well, nearly straight. A suitable Aes Sedai answer.
As well I do not intend to cross a bridge, then. I have no wish to be birched.
In the West stable she had Arrow saddled, without saddlebags. There was no need for them for a ride in the city, and no matter what she had told Edith, the sitter might send someone to check. Moiraine would have. With luck, no one would suspect anything before nightfall. Her first stop was Mistress Dormila's, where the banker had a number of letter of rights ready in various amounts, and 4 fat leather purses containing 200 crowns in gold and silver between them. The coin would sustain Moiraine for some time. The letters of rights were for after the coin was gone and for emergencies. Once she used one, she would need to move fast. The tower's eyes and ears would be looking for her, and no matter how discreet bankers were, the tower generally learned what it wanted to learn. Mistress Dormila asked no questions, of course, but on learning that Moiraine was alone, she offered 4 of her footmen as escort, and Moiraine accepted. She had no fear of footpads, who were few in Tarvalon and easily handled in any event, but if anyone did think of robbery, better they were frightened off by a bodyguard than chased away with the power. That would attract attention. Wealthy women often rode with bodyguards, even in Tarvalon. The men who walked in a box around Arrow as she departed the bankers might have been called footmen, but though they wore plain gray coats, they were muscular men who looked accustomed to the swords hanging from their belts. Doubtless they were the footmen who had overcome Master Gorthanas, or whatever his true name was. They,
or men like them. Banks always had guards, though never called that. At Tamura's shop, she sent two of the men with coin to purchase a travel trunk and hire a pair of porters, then changed into one of the riding dresses that marked her as a minor Kyrianan noble. Three of the five were embroidered, but lightly, and she did not complain. Too late to have it picked out, in any case. Tamura asked no more questions than Mistress Dormila had. One deferred to one's seamstress, but in the end she was a seamstress. And, too, seamstresses had their own sense of discretion, or they did not remain in business long. Before leaving, Moiraine tucked her great serpent ring into her belt pouch. Her hand felt oddly naked without it. Her finger itched for the small circle of gold, but too many in Tarvalin knew what it meant. For now, she truly must hide. With her small entourage, she progressed northward, making stops that filled the chest on the porter's shoulder poles with the needful things she could not have brought out of the tower unnoticed, until at last they reached North Harbor, where the city walls curved out into the river and made a ring near a mile across, broken only by the harbor mouth. Wooden-roofed docks lined the inside of that huge ring and moored river ships in every size. A few words with the dock mistress, a heavy-set graying woman with a harassed expression, gained her directions to the Blue Wing, a two-masted vessel. Blue Wing was not the largest vessel at the docks, but it was scheduled to sail within the hour. Soon enough, Arrow had been hoisted aboard by a long wooden boom with straps beneath her belly and secured on deck. The porters had been paid off, the footmen sent away with a silver mark each in thanks, and her trunk made snug in a small quarter-deck cabin. Still, she would be spending more time than she would like in that cabin, so she remained on deck scratching Arrow's nose while the river ship was untied and pushed off, and the long sweeps pushed out to maneuver Blue Wing across the harbor like some immense water bug. That was why she saw the dock mistress pointing to Blue Wing and talking to a man who held his dark cloak around him tightly while he stared at the vessel. Immediately she embraced Sayadar, and everything became clearer in her sight, sharper. The effect was not so good as a fine looking-glass, yet she could make out the man's face, peering avidly from his hood. Mr. Stormila's description had been exact. He was not pretty, but good-looking despite the scar at the corner of his left eye, and he was very tall for a Kyrian, close to 2 paces. But how had he found her here, and why had he been searching? She could not think of a pleasant answer to either question, least of all the second. For someone who wanted to stop the Hall's scheme, someone who wanted another house than Domodred on the Sun Throne, the easiest way would be the death of the Hall's candidate. Fixing the fellow's face in memory, she let the power drain away. Another reason to take care, it appeared. He knew the vessel she traveled by, and likely every stop intended between here and the borderlands. That had seemed the best place to begin, far from Kyrian and easily reached by the river. "Is Blue Wing a fast ship, Captain Carney?" she asked. The captain, a wide, sun-dark man with narrow mustaches waxed to spikes, stopped shouting orders and put on a semblance of a respectful smile. He had been quite pleased to take a noblewoman's gold for herself and a horse.
"The fastest on the river, to be sure, my lady," he said, and returned to shouting at his crew. He already had half the gold, and only needed to show respect enough to ensure he got the rest.
Any captain might have said the same of his vessel, but when the wind caught the triangular sails, Blue Wing leaped like its namesake, all but flying out of the harbor mouth. At that moment, Moiraine passed into disobedience to the Ammerlin seat. Oh, Sierran surely would have seen it from the instant she left the tower, but intention was not action. Whatever penance the woman set likely would combine labor, deprivation, mortification of the flesh, and mortification of the spirit, on top of which she almost certainly had an assassin trailing her. Her knees should have been shaking in fear of Sierran, if not Master Gorthanas. But as Tarvalin and the tower began shrinking behind her, all she felt was a great burst of freedom and excitement. They could not put her on the Sun Throne now. By the time the Hall found her, another would be secure in it. and she was off to find the boy child. She was off on an adventure as grand as any ever undertaken by an Aes Sedai.
Chapter 15. Into Canluam. The air of Kandor held the sharpness of new spring when Lan returned to the lands where he had always known he would die. Long past the arrival of spring in more southerly lands, here trees bore the first red of new growth, and a few scattered wildflowers dotted winter-brown grass, where shadows did not cling to patches of snow, yet the pale sun offered little warmth after the south gray clouds hinted at more than rain, and a cold gusting breeze cut through his coat. Perhaps the south had softened him more than he knew. A pity, if so. He was almost home. Almost. 100 generations had beaten the wide road nearly as hard as the stone of the surrounding hills, and little dust rose, though a steady stream of ox carts was leaving the morning farmers' markets in Canluam, and merchant trains of tall wagons, surrounded by mounted guards in steel caps and bits of armor, flowed toward the city's high gray walls. Here and there the chains of the Kandori Merchants' Guild spanned a chest, or an Arafelan wore bells in her hair, a ruby decorated this man's ear, a pearl brooch this woman's breast. But for the most part, the traders' clothes were as subdued as their manner. A merchant who flaunted too much profit discovered it hard to find bargains. By contrast, farmers showed off their success when they came to town. Bright embroidery decorated the striding countrymen's baggy breeches, the women's wide trousers, their cloaks fluttering in the wind. Some wore colored ribbons in their hair or a narrow fur collar. They might have been dressed for the coming Beltane dances and feasting. Yet country folk eyed strangers as warily as any guard, eyed them in hefted spears or axes, and hurried along. The times carried an edge in Kandor, maybe all along the borderlands. Bandits had sprung up like weeds this past year, and more troubles than usual out of the blight. Rumor even spoke of a man who channeled the One Power. But then, rumor often did. Leading Cat Dancer toward Canluam, Lan paid as little attention to the stares he and his companion attracted as he did to Bukama's scowls and carping. For all his talk of taking a rest, the longer they had remained in the south, the grumpier Bukama had grown. This time his mutters were for a stone-bruised hoof that had him afoot. They did attract attention, two very tall men walking their mounts, and a pack horse with a pair of tattered wicker hampers, their plain clothes worn and travel-stained. Their harness and weapons were well-tended, though. A young man and an old, hair hanging to their shoulders and held back by a braided leather cord around the temples. The Hadori drew eyes, especially here in the borderlands, where people had some idea what it meant.
"Fools," Bukama grumbled. "Do they think we're bandits? Do they think we mean to rob the lot of them at midday on the high road?"
He glared and shifted the sword at his hip in a way that brought considering stares from a number of merchants' guards. A stout farmer prodded his ox wide of them. Lan kept silent. A certain reputation clung to Melchiori, who still wore the Hadori, though not for banditry. But reminding Bukama would only send him into an even blacker humor for days. His mutters shifted to the chances of a decent bed that night, of a decent meal before. Bukama expected little and trusted to less. Neither food nor lodging entered Lan's thoughts, despite the distance they had traveled. His head kept swinging north. He remained aware of everyone around him, especially those who glanced his way more than once, aware of the jingle of harness and the creak of saddles, the clop of hooves, the snap of wagon canvas loose on its hoops. Any sound out of place would shout at him. He remained aware, but the blight lay north. Still miles away across the hills, yet he could feel it, feel the twisted corruption. Just his imagination, but no less real for that. It had pulled at him in the south, in Cairhien and Andor, even in Tyr, almost 500 leagues distant. 2 years away from the borderlands, his personal war abandoned for another, and every day the tug grew stronger. He should never have let Bukama talk him into waiting, letting the south soften him. The Aiel had helped maintain his edge. The blight meant death to most men. Death and the shadow, in a rotting land tainted by the Dark One's breath, where anything at all could kill. An insect bite, the prick of the wrong thorn, a touch of the wrong leaf. A boat of Trollocs and Murdrol and worse. Two tosses of a coin had decided where to begin anew. Four nations bordered the Blight, but his war covered the length of it, from the Arith Ocean to the spine of the world. One place to meet death was as good as another. He was almost home, almost back to the Blight. He had been away too long. A dry moat surrounded Canlewum's wall, 50 paces wide and 10 deep, spanned by 5 broad stone bridges with towers at either end, as tall as those that lined the wall itself. Raids out of the Blight by Trollocs and Murdrol often struck much deeper into Kandor than Canlewum, but none had ever made it inside the city's walls. The red stag waved above every tower. A proud man, Lord Varan, the high seat of House Markasiev. Queen Atheniella did not fly so many of her own banners, even in Chachin itself. The guards at the outer towers, in helmets with Varan's antlered crest, and the red stag on their chests, peered into the backs of wagons before allowing them to trundle onto the bridge, or occasionally motioned someone to push a hood further back. No more than a gesture was necessary. The law in every borderland forbade hiding your face inside village or town, and no one wanted to be mistaken for one of the eyeless trying to sneak into the city. Hard gazes followed Lan and Bukama onto the bridge. Their faces were clearly visible, and their Hadori. No recognition lit any of those watching eyes, though. 2 years was a long time in the borderlands. A great many men could die in 2 years. Lan noticed that Bukama had gone silent. Always a bad sign.
Be easy, Bukama.
I never start trouble, the older man snapped. But he did stop fingering his sword hilt. The guards on the wall above the open iron-plated gates and those on the bridge wore only back and breastplates for armor. Yet they were no less watchful, especially of a pair of Malkieri, with their hair tied back. Bukama's mouth grew tighter at every step.
A landman Dragorin! The light preservers, we heard you were dead fighting the Aiel at the Shining Walls!
The exclamation came from a young guard, taller than the rest, almost as tall as Lan. Young, perhaps a year or two less than he, yet the gap seemed 10 years. A lifetime. The guard bowed deeply, left hand on his knee.
Tyshar Malkier!
True blood of Malkier.
I stand ready, Majesty.
I am not a king,
Lan said quietly. Malkier was dead. Only the war still lived. In him, at least. Bukama was not quiet.
You stand ready for what, boy?
The heel of his bare hand struck the guard's breastplate right over the red stag, driving the man upright and back a step.
You cut your hair short and leave it unbound,
Bukama spat the words.
You're sworn to a Kandori lord. By what right do you claim to be Malkieri?
The young man's face reddened as he floundered for answers. Other guards started toward the pair, then halted when Lan let his reins fall. Only that, but they knew his name now. They eyed his bay stallion, standing still and alert behind him, almost as cautiously as they did him. A warhorse was a formidable weapon, and they could not know Cat Dancer was only half-trained yet. Space opened up as people already through the gates hurried a little distance before turning to watch, while those still on the bridge pressed back. Shouts rose in both directions from people wanting to know what was holding traffic. Bukama ignored it all, intent on the red-faced guard. He had not dropped the reins of the pack horse, or his yellow roan gelding. There was that for a hope to walk on without blades being bared. An officer appeared from the stone guardhouse inside the gates, crested helmet under his arm, but one hand in a steel-backed gauntlet resting on his sword hilt. A bluff, graying man with white scars on his face, Alin Seroku, had soldiered 40 years along the Blight, yet his eyes widened slightly at the sight of Lan. Plainly he had heard the tales of Lan's death, too.
The light shine upon you, Lord Mandragoran. The son of Eliana and Alakir, blessed be their memories, is always welcome.
Siraku's eyes flickered toward Bukama, not in welcome. He planted his feet in the middle of the gateway. 5 horsemen could have passed easily on either side, but he meant himself for a bar, and he was. None of the guards shifted a boot, yet every one had hand on sword hilt. All but the young man meeting Bukama's glares with his own.
Lord Markasiev has commanded us to keep the peace strictly,
Seroku went on, half an apology, but no more than half.
The city is on edge. All these tales of a man channeling are bad enough, but there have been murders in the street this last month and more, in broad daylight. And strange accidents. People whisper about shadow spawn loose inside the walls.
Lan gave a slight nod. With the blight so close, people always muttered of shadow spawn, when they had no other explanation, whether for a sudden death or unexpected crop failure. He did not take up Cat Dancer's reins, though.
We intend to rest here a few days before riding north.
Rest, and try to regain his edge. For a moment, he thought Seroku was surprised. Did the man expect pledges to keep the peace, or apologies for Bukama's behavior? Either would shame Bukama now. A pity if the war ended here. Lan did not want to die killing Kandori. His old friend turned from the young guard, who stood quivering, fists clenched at his sides.
All fault here is mine, Bukama announced to the air in a flat voice. I had no call for what I did. By my mother's name I will keep Lord Markasiev's peace. By my mother's name I will not draw sword inside Kanluom's walls.
Seroku's jaw dropped and Lan hid his own shock with difficulty. Hesitating only a moment, the scar-faced officer stepped aside, bowing and touching sword hilt, then heart.
There is always welcome for Landman Dragon and Daishan, he said formally, and for Bukama Maranellan, the hero of Salmarna. May you both know peace one day. There is peace in the mother's last embrace, Lan responded with equal formality, touching hilt and heart. May she welcome us home one day, Seroku finished.
No one really wished for the grave, but that was the only place to find peace in the Borderlands. Face like iron, Bukama strode ahead pulling Sunlance and the pack horse after him, not waiting for Lan. This was not well. Kanluom was a city of stone and brick, its paved streets twisting around tall hills. The Aiel invasion had never reached the borderlands, but the ripples of war always diminished trade a long way from any battles, and now that fighting and winter were both finished, the city had filled with people from every land. Despite the blight practically on the city's doorstep, gemstones mined in the surrounding hills made Kanluom wealthy, and strangely enough, some of the finest clockmakers anywhere. The cries of hawkers and shopkeepers shouting their wares rose above the hum of the crowd, even away from the terraced market squares. Colorfully dressed musicians or jugglers or tumblers performed at every intersection. A handful of lacquered carriages swayed through the mass of people and wagons and carts and barrows, and horses with gold or silver-mounted saddles and bridles picked their way through the throng, their riders' garb embroidered as ornately as the animal's tack, and trimmed with fox or marten or ermine. Hardly a foot of street was left bare anywhere. Lan even saw several Aes Sedai, women with serene, ageless faces. Enough people recognized them on sight that they created eddies in the crowd, swirls to clear away. Respect or caution, awe or fear, there were sufficient reasons for a king to step aside for a sister. Once you might have gone a year without seeing an Aes Sedai, even in the borderlands, but the sisters seemed to be everywhere since their old Amarlan seat died. Maybe it was those tales of a man channeling. They would not let him run free long, if he existed. He kept his eyes away from them, walked on quickly to avoid notice. The Hadori could be enough to attract the interest of a sister seeking a warder. Supposedly they asked before bonding a man. But he knew several who had taken that bond, and every time it had come as a surprise. Who would give up his freedom to trot at an Aes Sedai's heels unless there was more to it than asking? Shockingly, lace veils covered many women's faces. Thin lace, sheer enough to reveal that they had eyes, and no one had ever heard of a female murdral, but Lan had never expected law to yield to mere fashion. Next they would take down the oil lamps lining the streets and let the nights grow black. Even more shocking than the veils, Bukama looked right at some of those women and did not open his mouth. Then a jut-nosed man named Nazar Kuranin rode in front of Bukama's eyes, and he did not blink. The young guard surely had been born after the blight swallowed Malkir, but Kuranin, his hair cut short and wearing a forked beard, was twice Lan's age. The years had not erased the marks of his Hadori completely. There were many like Kiranin, and the sight of him should have set Bukama spluttering. Lan eyed his friend worriedly. They had been moving steadily toward the center of the city, climbing toward the highest hill, Stag's Stand. Lord Markasiev's fortress-like palace covered the peak, with those of lesser lords and ladies on the terraces below. Any threshold up there offered warm welcome for Alain Mandragoran, perhaps warmer than he wanted now. Balls and hunts, with nobles invited from as much as 50 miles away, including from across the border with Arafel. People avid to hear of his adventures. Young men wanting to join his forays into the Blight, and old men to compare their experiences there with his. Women eager to share the bed of a man fool stories claimed the Blight could not kill. Kandor and Arafel were as bad as any Southland at times. Some of those women would be married. And there would be men like Kiranin, working to submerge memories of lost Melkir. And women who no longer adorned their foreheads with the Kaisine in pledge that they would swear their sons to oppose the Shadow while they breathed. He could ignore the false smiles while they named him Alain Daishan, diademed battle lord and uncrowned king of a nation betrayed while he was in his cradle. In his present mood, Bukama might do murder. Or worse, given his oaths at the gate. He would keep those to the death. But Bukama's hands and feet were dangerous enough to maim a man for life. Varan Markasiev will hold us a week or more with ceremony, Lan said, turning down a narrower street that led away from the stand. With what we've heard of bandits and the like, he will be just as happy if I don't appear to make my bows. True enough. He had met the high seat of House Markasiev only once, years past, but he remembered a grave-faced man given entirely to his duties. Lord Markasiev would arrange those balls and hunts, and regret every one. Bukama followed without complaint about missing a palace bed, or the feasts the cooks would prepare. It was worrying. Along with regaining his own edge, he needed to find a way to sharpen Bukama's, or they might as well open their veins now. Chapter 16. The Deeps. No palaces rose in the hollows toward the north wall, only shops and taverns, inns and stables and wagon yards. Bustle surrounded the factors' long warehouses, but no carriages came to the deeps, and most streets were barely wide enough for carts. They were just as jammed with people as the wide ways, though, and every bit as noisy. Here the street performers' finery was tarnished, yet they made up for it by being louder, and buyers and sellers alike bellowed as if trying to be heard in the next street. Likely some of the crowd were cutpurses, slipfingers, and other thieves, finished with the morning's business higher up or headed there for the afternoon. It would have been a wonder otherwise, with so many merchants in town. The second time unseen fingers brushed his coat in the crowd, Lan tucked his purse under his shirt. Any banker would advance him more against the Shinarin estate he had been granted on reaching manhood, but loss of the gold on hand meant accepting the hospitality of Stag's Stand. At the first three inns they tried, slate-roofed cubes of gray stone with bright signs out front, the innkeepers had not a cubbyhole to offer. Lesser traders and merchants' guards filled them to the attics. Bukama began to mutter about making a bed in a hayloft, yet he never mentioned the feather mattresses and linens waiting on the stand. Leaving their horses with hostlers in a fourth inn, the Blue Rose, Lan entered determined to find some place for them if it took the rest of the day. Inside, a graying woman, tall and handsome, presided over a crowded common room where talk and laughter almost drowned out the slender girl singing to the music of her zither. Pipe smoke wreathed the ceiling beams, and the smell of roasting lamb floated from the kitchens. As soon as the innkeeper saw Lan and Bukama, she gave her blue-striped apron a twitch and strode toward them, dark eyes sharp. Before Lan could open his mouth, she seized Bukama's ears, pulled his head down, and kissed him. Kandori women were seldom retiring, but even so it was a remarkably thorough kiss in front of so many eyes. Pointing fingers and snickering grins flashed among the tables.
"It's good to see you again too, Rassel," Bukama murmured with a small smile when she finally released him. "I didn't know you had an inn here. Do you think..."
He lowered his gaze rather than meeting her eyes rudely, and that proved a mistake. Rassel's fist caught his jaw so hard that his hair flailed as he staggered.
6 years without a word, she snapped. 6 years!
Grabbing his ears again, she gave him another kiss, longer this time. Took it, rather than gave. A sharp twist of his ears made every attempt to do anything besides standing bent over and letting her do as she wished. At least she would not put a knife in his heart if she was kissing him. Perhaps not.
"I think Mistress Arafni might find Bukama a room somewhere," a man's familiar voice said dryly behind Lan. "And you too, I suppose."
Turning, Lan clasped forearms with the only man in the room beside Bukama of a height with him, Rhine Venomar, his oldest friend except for Bukama. The innkeeper still had Bukama occupied as Rhine led Lan to a small round table in the corner. 5 years older, Rhine was Melchiori too, but his hair fell in two long bell-laced braids, and more silver bells lined the turned-down tops of his boots and ran up the sleeves of his yellow coat. Bukama did not exactly dislike Rhine, not exactly, yet in his present mood only Nazar Kurinin could have had a worse effect. While the pair of them were settling themselves on benches, a serving maid in a striped apron brought hot spiced wine. Apparently Rhine had ordered as soon as he saw Lan. Dark-eyed and full-lipped, she stared Lan up and down openly as she set his mug in front of him, then whispered her name, Lyra, in his ear, and an invitation if he was staying the night. All he wanted that night was sleep, so he lowered his gaze, murmuring that she honored him too much. Lyra did not let him finish. With a raucous laugh, she bent to bite his ear hard. "By tomorrow," she announced in a throaty voice and loudly, "I'll have honored you till your knees won't hold you up." Raucous laughter flared at the tables around them. Rhine forestalled any possibility of writing matters, tossing her a fat coin and giving her a slap on the bottom to send her off. Lyra offered him a dimpled smile as she slipped the silver into the neck of her dress, but she left sending smoky glances over her shoulder at Lan that made him sigh. If he tried to say no now, she might well pull a knife over the insult.
"So your luck still holds with women, too."
Rhine's laugh had an edge. Perhaps he fancied her himself.
"The light knows they can't find you handsome. You get uglier every year. Maybe I ought to try some of that coy modesty. Let women lead me by the nose."
Lan opened his mouth, then took a drink instead of speaking. He should not have to explain, but it was too late for explanation with Rhine in any case. His father had taken him to Arafel the year Lan turned 10. The man wore a single blade on his hip instead of two on his back, yet he was Arafelan to his toenails. He actually started conversations with women who had not spoken to him first. Lan, raised by Bukama and his friends in Shinar, had been surrounded by a small community who held to Melchiori ways. If Lyra did share his bed tonight, as seemed certain, she would discover there was nothing shy or retiring about him once they were abed. Yet the woman chose when to enter that bed and when to leave. A number of people around the room were watching their table, sidelong glances over mugs and goblets. A plump, copper-skinned woman, wearing a much thicker dress than Domani women usually did, made no effort to hide her stares as she spoke excitedly to a fellow with curled mustaches and a large pearl in his ear. Probably wondering whether there would be trouble over Lyra. Wondering whether a man wearing the Hadori really would kill at the drop of a pin.
"I didn't expect to find you in Candlewom," Lan said, setting the wine mug down. "Guarding a merchant train?"
Bukama and the innkeeper were nowhere to be seen. Rhine shrugged.
"Out of Shul Arbella. The luckiest trader in Arafel, they say." "Said. Much good it did him. We arrived yesterday, and last night footpads slit his throat 2 streets over. No return money for me this trip."
He flashed a rueful grin and took a deep pull at his wine, perhaps to the memory of the merchant, or perhaps to the lost half of his wages.
"Burn me if I thought to see you here, either."
"You shouldn't listen to rumors, Rhine. I've not taken a wound worth mentioning since I rode south."
Lan decided to twit Bukama, if they did get a room, about whether it was already paid for and how. Indignation might take him out of his darkness.
"The Aiel," Rhine snorted. "I never thought they could put paid to you."
He had never faced Aiel, of course.
"I expected you to be wherever Edain Errol is. Chachin, now I hear."
That name snapped Lan's head back to the man across the table.
"Why should I be near the Lady Errol?" he demanded softly.
Softly, but emphasizing her proper title.
"Easy, man,"
Ryan said. I didn't mean... Wisely, he abandoned that line.
Burn me. Do you mean to say you haven't heard? She's raised the Golden Crane. In your name, of course. Since the year turned, she's been from Felmoran to Maradon, and coming back now.
Ryan shook his head, the bells in his braids chiming faintly.
There must be 200 or 300 men right here in Canlum ready to follow her. You, I mean. Some you'd not believe. Old Kieranin wept when he heard her speak. All ready to carve Melchior out of the Blight again.
What dies in the Blight is gone,
Lan said wearily. He felt more than cold inside. Suddenly Seroku's surprise that he intended to ride north took on new meaning, and the young guard's assertion that he stood ready. Even the looks here in the common room seemed different. And Idain was part of it. Always she liked standing in the heart of the storm.
I must see to my horse, he told Ryan, scraping his bench back.
Ryan said something about making a round of the taverns that night, but Lan hardly heard. He hurried through the kitchens, hot from iron stoves and stone ovens and open hearths, into the cool of the stable yard, the mingled smells of horse and hay and wood smoke. A gray lark warbled on the edge of the stable roof. Gray larks came even before robins in the spring. Gray larks had been singing in Felmoran when Idain first whispered in his ear. The horses had already been stabled, bridles and saddles and pack saddle atop saddle blankets on the stall doors, but the wicker hampers were gone. Plainly Mistress Aravni had sent word to the ostlers that he and Bukama were being given accommodation. There was only a single groom in the dim stable, a lean, hard-faced woman mucking out. Silently she watched him check Cat Dancer and the other horses as she worked, watched him begin to pace the length of the straw-covered floor. He tried to think, but Idain's name kept spinning through his head. Idain's face, surrounded by silky black hair that hung below her waist, a beautiful face, with large dark eyes that could drink a man's soul, even when filled with command. After a bit, the groom mumbled something in his direction, touching her lips and forehead, and hurriedly shoved her half-filled barrow out of the stable, glancing over her shoulder at him. She paused to shut the doors, and did that hurriedly too, sealing him in shadow, broken only by a little light from open hay doors in the loft. Dust motes danced in the pale golden shafts. Lan grimaced. Was she that afraid of a man wearing the Hadori? Did she think his pacing a threat? Abruptly, he became aware of his hands running over the long hilt of his sword, aware of the tightness in his own face. Pacing? No, he had been in the walking stance called leopard in high grass, used when there were enemies on all sides. He needed calm. Seating himself cross-legged on a bale of straw, he assumed the kodi and floated in calm emptiness, one with the bale beneath him, the stable, the scabbarded sword folded behind him. He could feel the horses cropping at their mangers and flies buzzing in the corners. They were all part of him, especially the sword. This time, though, it was only the motionless void that he sought. From his belt pouch he took a heavy gold signet ring, worked with a flying crane, and turned it over and over in his fingers. The ring of Melchiori kings, worn by men who had held back the shadow 900 years and more. Countless times it had been remade as time wore it down. Always the old ring melted to become part of the new. Some particle might still exist in it of the ring worn by the rulers of Ramdishar that had lived before Malkir. And Aramael that had been before Ramdishar. That piece of metal represented over 3,000 years fighting the Blight. It had been his almost as long as he had lived, but he had never worn it. Even looking at the ring was a labor usually, one he disciplined himself to every day. Without the emptiness, he did not think he could have done so today. In Kodi, thought floated free, and emotion lay beyond the horizon. In his cradle he had been given 4 gifts, the ring in his hands and the locket that hung around his neck, the sword on his hip, and an oath sworn in his name. The locket, containing the painted images of the mother and father he could not remember seeing in life, was the most precious, the oath the heaviest. To stand against the shadow so long as iron is hard and stone abides,
to defend the Malkyrie while one drop of blood remains, to avenge what cannot be defended. And then he had been anointed with oil and named Daishan, consecrated as the next king of Malkyr, and sent away from a land that knew it would die. Nothing remained to be defended now, only a nation to avenge. And he had been trained to that from his first step. With his mother's gift at his throat and his father's sword in his hand, with the ring branded on his heart, he had fought from his 16th name day to avenge Malkyr. But never had he led men into the Blight. Bukama had ridden with him and others, but he would not lead men there. That war was his alone. The dead could not be returned to life, a land any more than a man. Only now, Idain Errol wanted to try. Her name echoed in the emptiness within him. 100 emotions loomed like stark mountains, but he fed them into the flame until all was still, until his heart beat time with the slow stamping of the stalled horses, and the fly's wings beat rapid counterpoint to his breath. She was his Carnaira, his first lover. 1,000 years of tradition shouted that, despite the stillness that enveloped him. He had been 15, Idain more than twice that, when she gathered the hair that had still hung to his waist in her hands and whispered her intentions. Women had still called him beautiful then, enjoying his blushes, and for half a year she had enjoyed parading him around on her arm and tucking him into her bed, until Bukama and the other men gave him the Hadori. The gift of his sword on his 10th name day had made him a man by custom along the border, though years early for it. Yet among Malkyrie, that band of braided leather had been more important. Once that was tied around his head, he alone decided where he went and when and why. And the dark song of the Blight had become a howl that drowned every other sound. The oath that had murmured so long in his heart became a dance his feet had to follow. Almost 10 years passed now that Idain had watched him ride away from Felmoran and been gone when he returned, yet he still could recall her face more clearly than that of any woman who had shared his bed since. He was no longer a boy to think that she loved him just because she had chosen to become his first lover. Yet there was an old saying among Malkyrie men, "Your Carnaira wears part of your soul as a ribbon in her hair forever." Custom, strong as law, made it so. One of the stable doors creaked open to admit Bukama, coatless, shirt tucked raggedly into his breeches. He looked naked without his sword. As if hesitant, he carefully opened both doors wide before coming all the way in.
"What are you going to do?" he said finally. "Rassel told me about the Golden Crane."
Lan tucked the ring away, letting emptiness drain from him. Idain's face suddenly seemed everywhere, just beyond the edge of sight.
"Rhyn says even Nazar Kurinin is ready to follow," he said lightly. "Wouldn't that be a sight to see?
An army could die trying to defeat the Blight. Armies had died trying. But the memories of Malkyr already were dying. A nation was memory as much as land.
That boy at the gates might let his hair grow and ask his father for the Hadori.
People were forgetting, trying to forget. When the last man who bound his hair was gone, the last woman who painted her forehead, would Malkyr truly be gone too?
Why, Rhyn might even get rid of those braids."
Any trace of mirth dropped from his voice as he added,
"But is it worth the cost? Some seem to think so."
Bukama snorted, yet there had been a pause. He might be one of those who did. Striding to the stall that held Sunlance, the older man began to fiddle with his roan's saddle on the stall door, as though suddenly forgetting why he had moved.
"There's always a cost for anything," he said, not looking up. "But there are costs, and costs. The Lady Idain..."
He glanced at Lan, then turned to face him.
"She was always one to demand every right and require the smallest obligation be met. Custom ties strings to you, and whatever you choose, she will use them like a set of reins unless you find a way to avoid it."
Carefully, Lan tucked his thumbs behind his sword belt. Bukama had carried him out of Malkyr tied to his back. the last of the five who survived that journey.
Bukama had the right of a free tongue, even when it touched Lan's carneira.
"How do you suggest I avoid my obligations without shame?"
he asked more harshly than he had intended. Taking a deep breath, he went on in a milder tone.
"Come. The common room smells much better than this. Ryan suggested a round of taverns tonight. Unless Mistress Aravni has claims on you."
"Oh, yes. How much will our rooms cost?"
"Good rooms? Not too dear, I hope."
Bukama joined him on the way to the doors, his face going red.
"Not too dear," he said hastily. "You have a pallet in the attic, and I'm in Rassel's rooms. I'd like to make a round, but I think Rassel, I don't think she means to let me. I, young whelp," he growled. "There's a lass named Lyra in there who's letting it be known you won't be using that pallet tonight or getting much sleep. So don't think you can..."
He cut off as they walked into the sunlight, bright after the dimness inside. The Greylark still sang of spring. Six men were striding across the otherwise empty yard. Six ordinary men, with swords at their belts, like any men on any street in the city. Yet Lan knew before their hands moved, before their eyes focused on him and their steps quickened. He had faced too many men who wanted to kill him not to know. And at his side stood Bukama, bound by oaths that would not let him draw, even had he been wearing his blade. Bare hands were poor weapons against swords, especially at these odds. If they both tried to get back inside the stable, the men would be on them before they could haul the door shut. Time slowed, flowed like cool honey.
"Inside and bar the doors," Lance snapped as his hand went to his hilt. "Obey me, armsman."
Never in his life had he given Bukama a command in that fashion, and the man hesitated a heartbeat, then bowed formally.
"My life is yours, Daishan," he said in a thick voice. "I obey."
As Lan moved forward to meet his attackers, he heard the bar drop inside with a muffled thud. Relief was distant. He floated in Kodi, one with the sword that came smoothly out of its scabbard. One with the men rushing at him, boots thudding on the hard-packed ground as they bared steel. A lean heron of a fellow darted ahead of the others, and Lan danced the forms. Time like cool honey. The Greylark sang, and the lean man shrieked as cutting the clouds removed his right hand at the wrist, and Lan flowed to one side so the rest could not all come at him together, flowed from form to form. Soft rain at sunset laid open a fat man's face, took his left eye, and a ginger-haired young splinter drew a gash across Lan's ribs with black pebbles on snow. Only in stories did one man face six without injury. The Rose Unfolds sliced down a bald man's left arm, and ginger hair nicked the corner of Lan's eye. Only in stories did one man face six and survive. He had known that from the start. Duty was a mountain, death a feather. And his duty was to Bukama, who had carried an infant on his back. For this moment he lived, though, so he fought, kicking ginger hair in the head, dancing his way toward death, danced and took wounds, bled and danced the razor's edge of life. Time, like cool honey, flowing from form to form, and there could only be one ending. Thought was distant. Death was a feather. Dandelion in the wind slashed open the now one-eyed fat man's throat. He had barely paused when his face was ruined. A fork-bearded fellow with shoulders like a blacksmith gasped in surprise as kissing the adder put Lan's steel through his heart. And suddenly Lan realized that he alone stood, with six men sprawled across the width of the stable yard. The ginger-haired youth thrashed his heels in the ground one last time, and then only Lan of the Seven still breathed. He shook blood from his blade, bent to wipe the last drops off on the blacksmith's too fine coat, sheathed his sword as formally as if he were in the training yard under Bukama's eye. Abruptly, people flooded out of the inn, cooks and stablemen, maids and patrons, shouting to know what all the noise was about, staring at the dead men in astonishment. Ryan was the very first, sword already in hand, his face blank as he came to stand by Lan. "Six," he muttered, studying the bodies.
You really do have the Dark One's own flaming luck.
Dark-eyed Lyra reached Lan only moments before Bukama, the pair of them gently parting slashes in his clothes to examine his injuries. She shivered delicately as each was revealed, but she discussed whether an Aes Sedai should be sent for to give healing, and how much stitching was needed in as calm a tone as Bukama, and disparagingly dismissed his hand on the needle in favor of her own. Mistress Aravni stalked about, holding her skirts up out of patches of bloody mud, glaring at the corpses littering her stable yard, complaining in a loud voice that gangs of footpads would never be wandering in daylight if the watch were doing its job. The Domani woman who had stared at Lan inside agreed just as loudly, and for her pains received a sharp command from the innkeeper to fetch the watch, along with a shove to start her on her way. It was a measure of Mistress Aravni's shock that she treated one of her patrons so, a measure of everyone's shock that the Domani woman went running without complaint. The innkeeper began organizing men to drag the bodies out of sight. Ryan looked from Bukama to the stable as though he did not understand. Perhaps he did not at that. But what he said was, "Not footpads, I think." He pointed to the fellow who looked like a blacksmith. "That one listened to a Dane Errol when she was here, and he liked what he heard. One of the others did too, I think." Bells chimed as he shook his head. "It's peculiar. The first she said of raising the Golden Crane was after we heard you were dead outside the Shining Walls. Your name brings men, but with you dead, she could be El Idain." He spread his hands at the looks Lan and Bukama shot him. "I make no accusations," he said hastily. "I'd never accuse the Lady Idain of any such thing. I'm sure she is full of all of a woman's tender mercy." Mistress Aravni gave a grunt hard as a fist, and Lyra murmured half under her breath that the pretty Arafelin knew little about women. Lan shook his head, not in denial. Idain might decide to have him killed if it suited her purposes. She might have left orders here and there in case the rumors about him proved false. But if she had, that was still no reason to speak her name in connection with this, especially in front of strangers. Bukama's hands stilled, holding open a slash down Lan's sleeve.
"Where do we go from here?" he asked quietly. "Chachin," Lan said after a moment. There was always a choice, but sometimes every choice was grim. "You'll have to leave Sunlance. I mean to depart at first light tomorrow." His gold would stretch to a new mount for the man.
6,
Ryan growled, sheathing his sword with considerable force.
"I think I'll ride with you. I'd as soon not go back to Shol Arbella until I'm sure Silene Noraman doesn't lay her husband's death at my boots. And it will be good to see the Golden Crane flying again."
Lan nodded. To put his hand on the banner and abandon what he had promised himself all those years ago, or to stop her if he could. Either way, he had to face Idain. The Blight would have been much easier.
Chapter 17. An Arrival. Chasing after prophecy, Moiraine had decided by the end of the first month, involved very little adventure and a great deal of boredom. Now, 3 months out of Tar Valon, her grand search consisted mainly of frustration. The 3 oaths still made her skin feel too tight, and now saddle soreness added to the mix. The wind rattled the closed shutters against their latches, and she shifted on the hard wooden chair, hiding impatience behind a sip of honeyless tea. In Kandor, comforts were kept to a minimum in a house of mourning. She would not have been overly surprised to see frost on the leaf-carved furniture or the steel-cased clock above the cold hearth. "It was all so strange, my lady," Jereen Najima sighed, and for the 10th time hugged her daughters to her fiercely, as though she would never release them. They seemed to find some comfort in the crushing grip. Perhaps 13 or 14, standing on either side of Jereen's chair, Kolar and Asella had her long black hair and large blue eyes still full of loss. Their mother's eyes seemed big, too, in a face shrunken by tragedy, and her plain gray dress appeared made for a larger woman. "Joseph was always careful with lanterns in the stable," she went on, "and he never allowed any kind of open flame. The boys must have carried little Jared out to see their father at his work, and another hollow sigh. They were all trapped. How could the whole stable be ablaze so fast? It makes no sense.
Little is ever senseless, Mistress Najima, Moiraine said soothingly, setting her cup on the small table at her elbow. She felt sympathy, but the woman had begun repeating herself.
We cannot always see the reason, yet we can take some comfort in knowing there is one. The wheel of time weaves us into the pattern as it wills, but the pattern is the work of the light.
Hearing herself, she suppressed a wince. Those words required dignity and weight her youth failed to supply. For a moment she wished for the agelessness, but the last thing she could afford was to have the name Aes Sedai attached to her visit. No sister had come calling on Jurine yet, but one would sooner or later.
As you say, my Lady Alice, the other woman murmured politely, though an unguarded shift of pale eyes spoke her thoughts. This outlander was a foolish child, noble or not.
The small blue stone of the Kessiera dangling onto Moiraine's forehead and one of Tamura's riding dresses in dark green upheld her supposed rank. People allowed questions from a noble they never would from a commoner, and accepted odd behavior as natural. Supposedly she was making sympathy calls in mourning for her own king. Not that many people seemed to be mourning laymen in Kyrian itself. The latest news she had from there, a month old, spoke of four houses laying claim to the throne, and fierce skirmishes, some approaching battles. Light, how many would die before that was settled? There would have been deaths had she gone along with the hall. The succession to the Sun Throne was always contested, whether through open warfare or assassination and kidnapping, but at least she had been gone long enough to put paid to that. And she would pay for doing so, atop whatever Sierran imposed for disobedience. Perhaps she let something of her anger show, and Mistress Najima took it to mean her own thoughts had been too clear, because she started up again, speaking anxiously. No one wanted to anger a noble, even an outland noble.
It's just that Joseph was always so lucky, my Lady Alice. Everyone spoke of it. They said if Joseph Najima fell down a hole, there'd be opals at the bottom. When he answered the Lady Karail's call to go fight the Aiel, I worried, but he never took a scratch. When camp fever struck, it never touched us or the children. Joseph gained the lady's favor without trying. Then it seemed the light truly did shine on us. Jared was born safe and whole, and the war ended, all in a matter of days. And when we came home to Canluam, the lady gave us the livery stable for Joseph's service, and...
She swallowed tears she would not shed. Kolar began to weep, and her mother pulled her closer, whispering comfort. Moiraine rose. More repetition. There was nothing here for her. Jurine stood, too, not a tall woman, yet almost a hand taller than she. Either of the girls could look her in the eyes. Forcing herself to take time, she murmured more condolences and tried to press a wash-leather purse on the woman as the girls brought her fur-lined cloak and gloves. A small purse. In the beginning, instinct had made her generous, even with the bounty to come, if not already received. But before long, she would need to find a bank. The woman's stiff-necked refusal to take the purse irritated her. No, she understood pride, and besides, Lady Karail had provided. The presence of a clock spoke of a prosperous household. The real irritant was her own desire to be gone. Jurine Najima had lost her husband and three sons in one fiery morning, but her Jared had been born in the wrong place by almost 20 miles. Moiraine disliked feeling relief in connection with the death of an infant, yet she did. The dead boy was not the one she sought. Outside, under a gray sky, she gathered her cloak tightly. Anyone who went about the streets of Canluam with an open cloak would draw stares. Any outlander, at least, unless clearly Aes Sedai. Besides, not allowing the cold to touch you did not make you entirely unaware of it. How these people could call this new spring without a hint of mockery was beyond her. Mentally, she drew a line through the name of Jurine Najima. Other names in the notebook residing in her belt pouch already had real lines inked through them. The mothers of 5 boys born in the wrong place or on the wrong day.
the mothers of three girls. Her initial optimism that she would be the one to find the boy child had faded to a faint hope. The book contained hundreds of names. Surely one of Tamra's searchers would locate him first. Still, she intended to go on. Years might pass before it was safe for her to return to Tarvalin. A great many years. Despite the near-freezing wind that gusted over the rooftops, the winding streets were packed with milling people and carts and wagons, and hawkers with their trays or barrows. Wagon drivers shouted and cracked their long whips to gain some headway, the women coming nearer to striking flesh than the men, and so managed to move in straight lines. But for her, it was a matter of picking her way, dodging around wagons and high-wheeled carts. She was certainly not the only outlander afoot in the streets. A Taraboner with heavy mustaches pushed past her, muttering a hasty apology, and an olive-skinned Altaran woman who scowled at her, then a smiling Ilianer with a beard that left his upper lip bare, a very pretty fellow and not too tall. A dark-faced Tyran in a striped cloak, even prettier, eyed her up and down and pursed his lips in betrayal of lascivious thoughts. He even moved as though to speak to her, but she let the wind catch one side of her cloak, flinging it open long enough to reveal the slashes on her breast. That sent him scurrying. He might have been willing to approach a merchant with his beautiful face and lewd suggestions, but a noble was another matter. Not everyone was forced to crawl. Twice she saw Aes Sedai strolling through the crowds, and those who recognized the ageless face leaped out of their paths and hastily warned others to move aside, so they walked in pools of open space that flowed along the street with them. Neither was a woman she had met, but she kept her head down and stayed to the other side of the street, far enough that they could not sense her ability. Perhaps she should put on a veil. A stout woman brushed by, features blurred behind lace. Sierran Vayu herself could have passed unrecognized at 10 feet in one of those. She shivered at the thought, ridiculous as it was. The inn where she had a small room was called the Gates of Heaven, 4 sprawling stories of green-roofed stone, Canluam's best and largest. Nearby shops, jewelers and goldsmiths, silversmiths and seamstresses catered to the lord and ladies on the stand, looming behind the inn. She would not have stopped in it had she known who else was staying there before paying for her room. There was not another room to be found in the city, but a hayloft would have been preferable. Taking a deep breath, she hurried inside. Neither the sudden warmth from fires on 4 large hearths nor the good smells from the kitchens eased her tight shoulders. The common room was large, and every table beneath the bright red ceiling beams was taken. The customers were plainly dressed merchants for the most part, bargaining in low voices over wine,